We're going to continue on in our series looking at wisdom. And this morning, as we begin, I just want to share a little bit, and this could be dangerous in some ways. And at one point during the week, I said to Becca, like, hey, do you mind if I share a story about us? And then I realized this morning that I never actually told her what that was about. So to think about our time in premarital counseling, premarital counseling was like, it was a great experience for us. It was this time where we were able to spend a lot of time talking about what our future was going to look like and kind of dreaming and hoping for certain things together. And I have talked with people, and I haven't been doing premarital counseling for very long, but over the last 8 years, I've had the opportunity to do it numbers of times. And whenever an opportunity's come up for that, it seems like the first thing when people walk into the office for that first session, they're like really nervous. There's like an impression people have that they think it's some kind of test at the end, and that if you don't answer all the questions correctly, or if it's like the newlywed game and you don't know everything about the other person, that you're going to fail and that the pastor won't perform the ceremony. Or some people think that it's going to be a time where they have to confess all of their deepest, darkest kinds of secrets in that premarital counseling time. And so lots of people that I've talked to come into it with this level of anxiety or anxiousness over what exactly is this going to have. But over and over again, what I've seen is that it's a really good thing, that it's this really healthy time where you talk and you dream and you think together about what your life is going to look like together when you're part of that profound mystery of the two becoming one. And so something that was certainly true in our marriage, and something that is true for lots and lots of marriages, was that even though we were really excited and ready and eager, even when we were in counseling, and then when we would leave and we'd talk about things, probably the area that us, and the area for lots of people that they are least prepared, is for the merging of the two becoming one in regards to bank accounts and finances, as opposed to lots of other things. And so there have been lots of times when I have talked to people who are newlyweds or who are just kind of starting out in life, and I have heard the same kind of laughable disagreement that's taken place over and over again. And it's something that we've experienced where, and not to be too stereotypical, but where husbands will get into this discussion about how, or a disagreement will arise about how husbands are spending lots of money on these really like fleeting temporary experiences. Maybe it's going out to Wings every week with their friends. Maybe it's playing golf. Maybe it's going to sporting events. Maybe it's something that's this kind of like entertainment thing. It's expensive. It's short-lived. And it costs a lot of money. And a wife will struggle with that. And then on the same end, I have seen so many times, and again, not to say that like all women love shopping or anything like that, but I have seen, though some are nodding, yes, but I've seen so many times where men on the opposite end have said, you know, if I hear one more time about the best new deal that was out there or how much money I saved when I was shopping, and over and over again heard kind of the rehearsed stump speech about places like Kohl's where everything is on sale, but they just do that to make you feel better about what you're buying. And this kind of discussion, it happens all the time. It happens when people are talking about shopping. It happens in so many ways throughout marriages, and it's laughable. And lots of times, both couples are talking about spending money. It's just a really different approach to money and how you view it and what it's for and how you save it and all kinds of different things. And so lots of marriages, right off the bat, once the honeymoon is over, and it's this season, you know, where they've been in a place where, you know, they're spending lots of money on a wedding. They're spending lots of money on a honeymoon. They're probably renting or buying a first house together. Maybe they're moving for a new town. So when you're in that mode, it's this time in life where you're spending all of this money. And then as life settles into this routine, there starts to emerge these differences in the way that you live and you approach life. And it happens in 100 different ways. But money is one of them. And the thing that isn't funny about that when it happens with money is that money is one of the most taxing, stressful things for couples to fight over, to argue over. That if you look at different people, some people say that financial issues and financial stress is the number one reason why people in America get divorced. And there are some that say that, and even if it isn't the number one reason, if you look at any list of reasons as to why people get divorced, money or financial stress is on that list. And it isn't the idea that there isn't enough money or that there isn't any money. It's this idea that people see money in all of these different ways, and they struggle to get on the same page, and it just can create a lot of tension for people. And so what I want us to look at this morning is just a chance to explore what does some of the wisdom literature that we've been looking at have to say in regards to money. And just to give a quick kind of disclaimer, if any of you, and I've referenced him before, and I know some people, like I know John's big on Dave Ramsey and Financial Peace. If any of you are familiar with Dave Ramsey, there are some things here that might seem familiar. There's a little bit of flavor of that we'll be in. And I'll also say this. This message is something that is for anyone. So I know I can remember kind of growing up in church, and if you're sitting there thinking, I don't have a job, or I don't have a full-time job, I'm not out of the house working, or maybe I'm retired already. You know, you're thinking about all these different stages in life. It doesn't mean that the idea of being wise with money isn't something that's important. So I know sometimes talking about finances can kind of be a little bit of a snooze fest or feel like that. But this morning, as we look to finances, we're going to focus in on one area, and that is just the idea of being generous with the money that we have been given by God. And so as we do that, we're going to ask a couple different questions. And the first one is this. It's what hinders us from being generous? What is it that stops us from being generous with the money that we have? And as a kind of another disclaimer, another thing I'll point out, is that when I say what hinders us from being generous, I'm not talking about us as a church. Whenever I was kind of putting this together and writing this, and I thought, what stops us from being generous? I stopped for a minute and I thought, I have not seen a lack of generosity or anything like that in the year that we've been kind of with CAC, or almost with CAC. It was a year ago today. It was on Father's Day last year that we came and candidated here and visited for a week. And so in that time, I have seen no sort of lack of generosity, and that's in the way that people give of their time, the way that people give of their finances, even in the two times over the course of this year where we've had special offerings for causes outside of our church. People have stepped up and given and helped in abundance and exceeded any of the expectations that we have. So this is nothing, when I say what hinders us, I'm not talking about CAC specifically, but just as people, what is it that hinders us from being people that are generous, and specifically generous with our finances? And I think that for lots of us, we fall into kind of a few different traps. Some of us think that we don't have enough money of our own to be able to be generous. Some of us think that if we just got a little bit further ahead, maybe if we just were able to pay off some of our own debt, maybe if we were able to pay off, whether it's student loans or car loans or mortgages, that then we'd be able to be a little bit more generous. Some of us think that if we just got maybe the next step up, the next pay grade at our jobs, that if we had just a little bit more money, that would fix everything. And then maybe we would be generous. Some of us maybe sit back and think, we don't really know anyone who's in need, or else we would be generous. Some of us think all of these different reasons we have that we can't be generous. And whenever we're doing that, the reality probably, if we dug a little bit deeper, is this, that one of the big things that hinders us from being generous is that we really like being able to hold on to our money. We really like being able to focus in on what it is that we have. And that makes sense for a reason. That makes sense because we work hard for our money. You know, lots of us, whether it's a job that you really love to have and you feel fulfilled when you go into work every day, or it's a job that you feel like mentally exhausted, I'm physically exhausted, I'm stressed out about the jobs, we work hard for the money that we have. And so we feel like we really want to hold on to that money. We like hanging on to the money. And the second reason is this, is that a lot of people around us who need money don't fit our standard of being worthy to help. That's kind of a thought process that a lot of us have. You know, a lot of us, when we, you know, if you're in a city area and you walk by someone who's homeless and who's asking for money, a lot of us immediately, and sometimes rightfully so, jump to conclusions about why that person needs help, about why that person needs money. And we decide they don't really fit our standard of someone who needs help. Or a lot of us think immediately that someone who doesn't have enough money because they're too lazy to work, or because they're too lazy to go out and get a job that provides enough money for them. And so we come up with all of these different ways where we're able to rationalize why we aren't generous with our money and why we aren't helping people that are around us. And the reality is this, that if we boil these things down, if we think about it, the first response of us liking to hang on to our money is really the root of something that's called selfishness. And the second reason is a way that we justify being selfish. So for lots of us, whenever we're not generous, whenever we're not helping others, whenever we're not focused on that, we're people who are being selfish. And Scripture addresses what it is like to be selfish, and it talks about it in a manner that's pretty harsh. And you know, all throughout Scripture, we see this principle of helping people who are in need, of helping people who are in a bad place, of taking care of people who can't take care of themselves. But one of the passages that maybe most directly talks about what it's like for us to be selfish comes to us in James chapter 3, verses 14 to 16. And in this passage, James is asking who is wise. And so he's kind of talking about who's wise, and he gives an answer about what it looks like to be wise. And then he follows that up by saying this, starting in verse 14. He says, "But if you have bitter jealousy and selfish ambition in your hearts, do not boast and be false to the truth. This is not the wisdom that comes down from above, but is earthly, unspiritual, and demonic. For where jealousy and selfish ambition exist, there will be disorder and every vile practice." And so I think when I look at that verse, and when I talked about how Scripture's harsh when it comes to being selfish, to having selfish ambition, when you look at this, I think lots of times, you know, it's really easy for us to come up with a scale of where sins are, you know, of what's wrong and then what's really wrong. And so if you're talking about feeling selfish or feeling envious, most of us put that on the pretty safe side of sins, the pretty minor side. You know, it's nothing like murder. It's nothing like committing a violent act against someone. It's nothing, you know, it's worse. It's lower than stealing. It's probably even, you know, feeling a little bit selfish isn't as bad as, you know, being mean to someone or saying something that's unkind to someone. Being selfish is pretty safe until we read a passage like this. Whenever James talks about how being selfish is something that is unspiritual, and then follows up on that to say it's demonic, that makes selfish ambition a pretty big deal. And then to go on from that and say that where jealousy and selfish ambition exists, there will be disorder and every vile practice. And that's in the ESV. In the NIV, it talks about every evil practice. It talks about this idea that being selfish is something that leads us onto a path that goes way beyond just only looking out for ourselves. That goes way beyond being a little bit envious of other people. Because once we become focused on ourselves and on getting what we feel like will satisfy us, it leads us into all of those other elements. It leads us into not looking for the best interest of other people, to taking advantage of other people, to taking things that belong to someone else, to coveting after what other people have, which leads us into all of these serious sins and consequences that in James's description is something that's demonic and something that puts us on a path to being evil. And when we think about that, specifically in regards to money, because James isn't necessarily talking specifically in regards to money, but when we think about that, one of the most familiar passages to us comes in 1 Timothy chapter 6, verse 10, where it says, "For the love of money is a root of all kinds of evils. It is through this craving that some have wandered away from the faith and pierced themselves with many pangs. And so, I mean, this passage, lots of people use this and misuse this passage. But to be clear, it's not saying that there's anything wrong with money. It's not saying that there's anything wrong with having money. Having money is a good and a great thing and a helpful thing in life. But it's talking about that love and desire of money. And it says that when we have this love and desire of money, that again, like James, it leads us into all of these kinds of envious and evil practices. And through this craving, it talks about how it damages our relationship with God. That we can become so focused on money that it's easy when we're focused on ourselves to wander away from our faith. And then that last line about how we pierce ourselves with many pangs. In other passages, it talks about being pierced with many sorrows. And so that idea of the pangs or the sorrows is saying that whenever we have a love of money, whenever that's our pursuit, it doesn't make things better for us. It only gives us a life that is full of problems, a life that's full of sorrow, that's rooted out of this envious, evil, kind of selfish self-absorbance that we have as people. So, why do we struggle to be generous? For most of us, it boils down to some reason of being selfish. And the next question is, why should we be generous? Why should we give away the money that we've worked for? Why should we give away what we have and what we've tried so hard to accumulate? And this is where we're really going to look into the wisdom literature. And the first reason we see is that it is wise for us to give money away. It's wise for us to be generous specifically with our finances. And we see that in Psalm 37, verses 21 and 22. And this is one of the Psalms of David. It says, "The wicked borrows but does not pay back, but the righteous is generous and gives. For those blessed by the Lord shall inherit the land, but those cursed by him shall be cut off." The wicked person is always out for what they can get. The wicked person is always out for what they can take from those around them, for how they can get ahead in life, for how they can be successful in life, for what they can do or scheme to accomplish to make life all about them. And in this passage, it says that a righteous person is one who is generous and gives to others. And in this passage, it even begins to hint at what it means to be generous and the blessing with that, to say that those who are blessed by the Lord shall inherit the land. So it connects a blessing that we'll talk about, a blessing with the idea of being generous. It goes on again in Psalm 112, we see this notion. And in Psalm 112, it's this whole psalm that's dedicated to the idea of what it is like to be a righteous person, to be a good person. And in it, it says this in verses 2 through 5 and then in verse 9. "His offspring will be mighty in the land. The generation of the upright will be blessed. Wealth and riches are in his house, and his righteousness endures forever. Light dawns in the darkness for the upright. He is gracious, merciful, and righteous. It is well with the man who deals generously and lends, who conducts his affairs with justice." So we see it all throughout that passage, that if a person is someone who's righteous, they're a person who's generous with what they have. They're a person who lends. They're a person who acts with justice. They're not always looking for what they can get and what they can achieve. And it follows it up in verse 9 by saying this: "He," that's the wise person, "has distributed freely. He has given to the poor. His righteousness endures forever. His horn is exalted in honor." It's clear that a life of righteousness, a life of living well, which is a life of wisdom, is one where we're people who give to those who are around us who are in need, who give freely to those around us who are in need. And that's the first reason. So it's wise. Why are we generous? Because it's wise to give our money away. And the second reason is this: because God has modeled generosity to us and made us in his image. And this is one of the areas where I love this story that Dave Ramsey shares in one of his books, where he says it took him a while. It was later in life where he really began to understand the generosity that God has for us. And he says he was kind of a relatively young Christian, and he got up one morning, and it was 5:30 in the morning, and he was downstairs in his study, and he said he was trying, he kind of makes reference to, he was trying again to be a person who read his Bible and prayed every morning. You know, it wasn't his first try, like lots of us can relate to, where he was up, he was focusing on the Word, and he was reading through the Gospel of John. And he said he started at 5:30 to hear kind of a stirring and a rustling happening upstairs. And as he heard someone coming down the steps, he knew that it was their youngest child. It was their only son. He has two daughters and one son. And he heard his son walking down the stairs. And he kind of thought, oh, well, study time is over, I guess, for this morning. And his son came into his lap and sat with him in the study, and they were reading together, and he read through John 3:16, where, of course, it talks about how God gives up his only begotten son on our behalf. And he said there was something that morning that clicked in his mind, that while his only son was sitting on his lap and he's reading this story about how God gave his only son on our behalf, that he began to understand even more than the way that provides for salvation, all of the ways that God is generous to us, all of the ways that God gives for us on our behalf. And not only that God has given us that, but that God has created us in his image to be people who are willing to give and to be generous to others. So God gives this to us as a way for us to follow in his lead of generosity. And generosity in all areas of life, not just in finances. And then the third reason why we should be generous is this: because it isn't ours in the first place. Because money, our possessions, the things that we work so hard for and hold on to so tightly, aren't really ours. They're actually God's. One of the places we see this is in Psalm chapter 24, verses 1 and 2. And this is a psalm that is proclaiming the glory of God and who he is. And it says, "The earth is the Lord's and the fullness thereof, the world and those who dwell therein. For he has founded it upon the seas and established it upon the rivers." That passage says that everything that we see around us belongs to God. And we all know, we all understand what it is to be a steward or a stewardess, right? No, not to be a flight attendant. But the whole idea behind being a steward is that we're a manager of something that is not ours. A steward is not an owner. A steward isn't the person who's really in charge. A steward isn't the person who has the big house. A steward is a manager of what belongs to someone else. And when we read through this psalm and we understand that the fullness of creation, that means everything, belongs to God, then it's easy for us to understand how we are stewards of what has been given to us. And the reality is that whenever we kind of come to that perspective, that what we have and who we are is not our own but belongs to God, it becomes much easier to be generous. It's always easier to be generous with someone else's money. It's always easier to be generous with someone else's time or talents. And the same is true for us. Whenever we have the perspective, God has given me everything I have. It's his. It's for his glory. How can I give it back? How can I help those who are in need? It helps us to be people who are generous. And then the final question for us this morning is this: what is the promise associated with being generous? And so if we think back, if we see that envy and selfish ambition lead us into evil, they lead us down a path where we're willing to forsake God, we're willing to forsake others, we're willing to take advantage of others, and we think about the way that a lot of us struggle in that cycle, where we think if we just had a little bit more, if we just worked a little bit longer or a little bit harder, we'd be able to finally get what we want. The truth is that we never experience the blessing that's associated with giving. Whenever we're focused in on the love of money and the love of possessions, it's hard for us to experience a way that God wants to bless us. And we see this blessing in Proverbs chapter 11, verses 24 and 25, where Solomon writes, "One gives freely, yet grows all the richer, and another withholds what he should give, and only suffers want. Whoever brings blessing will be enriched, and whoever waters will himself be watered. And this passage summarizes, you know, the whole idea behind what it means for us to be givers, what it means for us to be generous. And it says it really explicitly, but the imagery that I love in this passage is that the one who waters will himself be watered. And when you think about the idea of a plant that needs to be watered, you know, a plant needs to have moisture and water to survive. A plant needs to have moisture and water not just to survive in that moment, but to grow to maturity and to be able to produce fruit. And for us as people, we need that provision from God for us to be able to become mature in our faith and in our life and in our ability to live well and to be generous to others. And what we see in this passage from Solomon is that it's those of us who are watering others, that one who waters others will himself be watered. That there's a blessing from God that's connected with those who are generous. We also see this in 2 Corinthians in chapter 9, verses 6 to 9 in the New Testament, where Paul writes, "The point is this, whoever sows sparingly will also reap sparingly, and whoever sows bountifully will also reap bountifully." It's a pretty easy process that he describes there. "Each one must give as he has decided in his heart, not reluctantly or under compulsion, for God loves a cheerful giver, and God is able to make all grace abound to you, so that having all sufficiency in all things at all times, you may abound in every good work." And there's one piece I love about this passage, that it talks about the blessing that's connected to giving. That if we sow sparingly, we reap sparingly, and if we sow bountifully, we reap bountifully. But in that last line, when it talks about how we have all the sufficiency that we need from God in order to be able to abound in every good work, it kind of takes away all of those excuses we talked about in the beginning as to why we can't give. That God has given us everything that we need right where we are at. And we still, whether we feel like we have a lot or we feel like we have a little with our finances or with our skills and our talents and our time, if we feel like we have a lot or we feel like we have a little, God has given us enough that we're able to abound in every good work. He has provided for us so that we can be a people that provide for others. And that's the blessing that's provided through giving. And we're going to take a minute to watch a video this morning about giving. And this video is kind of, it's extraordinary. It's not an ordinary kind of connection with giving, but it's something that's important. So we're going to watch that now.
You know how sometimes it feels like life just happens? You know, just random things seem to fill your day. Things with little or no consequence to anyone else. I mean, I know God's in control of my life, but I never really saw how much He was weaving my story with other people's stories, and really, into His story. Well, that's all changed. It was a cold day, the kind where you really don't want to have some long conversation outside with someone, especially with someone you don't really know. But that's exactly what God had in mind. Amy and I had just eaten lunch at Dumplin's downtown Franklin, and we were walking to the car and we see this couple that I thought I recognized from church. It would have been awkward just to walk by him and not say anything, so we stopped and said, "Hey," and did the whole, yeah, you guys go to fellowship thing, whatever. Well, we start talking and the whole Dave Ramsey thing comes up. They asked us where we were in the process, and I told them that so far we paid off $60,000, but still had $10,000 left to go. They asked us what we would do when we were debt-free, and I laughed and told them, well, I told my kids I'd buy them a trampoline, but we really wanted to adopt, and we committed to being debt-free before we did. The whole conversation only lasted about 3 minutes. It was like, "Nice to meet you." That was random. Well, the next day, that random person shows up at my office with this brand new trampoline. I couldn't believe it. It was like, my kids are gonna freak. I set it up that night, and my kids jumped on that thing for 4 hours. I mean, we didn't even know these people. They didn't have to do that. I mean, really. That's pretty generous. Well, the next day, I get an email from the same lady saying, "Oh, you guys seem like a sharp couple, and we'd love to come by and talk to you about something." I emailed her back and said, That sounds like a multi-level marketing proposal. And if it was, we really weren't interested. Of course, she says it's not that sort of deal, but she was really persistent. She even called Amy. Amy had been sick, and it really wasn't a great time to have company over. Our house is a wreck, and we didn't feel like picking it up. We said everything short of, please don't come over to my house. So they show up, and I'm like, here we go. Let's get this over with. Don't say yes to anything. I couldn't believe they sunk their claws into us with that trampoline to get us involved in some pyramid scheme. Anyway, so we small talked for about 5 minutes, and then right when I thought they were about to drop the bomb, they did. But it wasn't the bomb I was expecting. So the lady says, well, we told you we'd only be a few minutes, and I really don't know how to say this, but we want to pay off your $10,000 left in debt so you guys can adopt. She pulls out her checkbook and goes, how do you spell your guys' names? What? Are you kidding me? Are you for real? I mean, who does that? Who writes somebody a check for $10,000 and gives it to people they don't even know? So they give us a check and they said, just don't act weird around us at church and just don't tell anybody it was us. And they drove off. I mean, Amy and I stood there for 10 minutes in total shock. Then we cried and we screamed and we ran all over the yard and the house. Unbelievable. I mean, seriously, it was beyond belief. We realized 9 months later when we brought Malaya home, the check they wrote us was dated 9 months prior to Malaya's due date. They gave us that money right about the time our daughter was conceived. It was like God was saying, I have a baby out there for you right now. I'm not waiting around another 2 years for you to pay off that debt. We felt called to adopt, but we simply couldn't afford to do it on our own. We found that this random couple had already adopted 4 children and felt a calling to continue to serve through adoption. Rather than bringing more children into their home, they decided to help others adopt. It didn't just happen. It wasn't random at all. God knew his plan. He had just invited us to walk with him through this process. He was weaving our callings, our stories together for us to love and to care for each other, to make a beautiful tapestry for his glory. Thank you, Jesus.
And so part of this story, I mean, it's an incredible story about generosity of people and about the way that this couple experienced generosity from others. But I think it's an awesome story from the perspective of the people who gave out of the abundance that they had and the way that God provided for them for others.